you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Things didn't have to turn out the way they did. Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour, and thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories on our 10th anniversary. The Twilight Histories is a show where you are the hero. You will travel to strange and exotic lands that could have been, but never were. You will meet people and see sights, visit wonders, and escape terrors that did not exist in our universe. This week, you will visit three versions of America. An America that might at first seem familiar, but that is very different. The first weird tale of America comes from Kevin Valbanese. Kevin will take you into the streets of Mexico, a Mexico that was conquered by America. This is A Man from Monterey by Kevin Valbanese.
High noon. The sun hangs overhead, scorching the streets of Monterrey without a single, solitary cloud to offer respite to the poor, thronging masses below. The heat above meets a heavy humidity below, leaving you and everyone else drenched in sweat. It's hardly a day to be out and about running errands, and it's certainly not the day you'd want to vote. And yet, here you are, standing smack dab in the middle of the Plaza del Gobierno, squeezing past the citizens of Monterrey as you make your way toward the Palacio. The fever of election is in full swing, with partisans of both major candidates proselytizing to the faithful and the indifferent in this 11th hour. In this tiny square, both campaigns have managed to erect several platforms from which they can fly banners, play music, and hurl promises at the crowds. Two names dominate the ornate displays here in the heart of Monterrey: Alphonse Reinhard and Hector Ignacio de León. Those names are on the lips of many soothsayers as they spin prophecies that would make John of Patmos blush. You'd think you'd entered the final millennium, and that the earth itself would tremble and rend itself apart if either candidate was to come away victorious today. Tempers flare up under the oppressive heat, and partisans of either side hurl insults at each other. But nothing comes to blows thanks to the show of force that is the American garrison. All dressed in their light blue uniforms and armed with rifles and bayonets, the soldiers keep the peace, moving in tight columns to position themselves between the most vocal rivals. Officers in darker blue jackets ride around on horseback, fanning themselves with their caps and keeping watch over the crowds. You hear the worst insults hurled at the Americans, but they remain stoic, unmoved in the face of utter contempt. Steering clear of the most obstinate members of the public, you take refuge in the Metropolitan Cathedral of Our Lady of Monterrey, a towering 18th century church with an ornate Baroque facade. You sit down against the corner of the building and fan yourself, trying to cool down. But even here, you feel yourself cooking as if you were in an oven. Don't bother, amigo. It won't do you any good. You look over and spot another man taking refuge in the shade. He's dressed in the manner of a vaquero, a cowboy, wearing a thin, well-worn jacket over a sweat-stained shirt. He also has sturdy trousers covered with filthy chaps. You can only make out the lower half of his face, the rest being hidden under the wide brim of his hat. Just relax, and your body will cool itself down. The man tips his hat at you. You're definitely not ready to go out again in the sun, and with nobody else to talk to, you force out what small talk you can offer. So, do you like the candidates? The man smiles, scoffs. He folds his arms together and looks down at his feet. That's like asking if I prefer scorpions to snakes, amigo. The man fishes out a pipe and stuffs it with tobacco, striking a match to get it going. He exhales a thick, pungent cloud of smoke in your direction. Still, this is the first time in 20 years we even get to choose. There hasn't been a Mexican leader in Mexico since the Americans strung up Santa Ana many, many years ago. I take it that Ignacio de Leon is your man, then. He's as good as he comes. It would be better if he was from here and not some aristocrat from La Capital. But like I said, at least he's one of us. The man pulls a pocket watch out from his trousers, and you can't help noticing how shiny it is, untarnished despite this man's very rural occupation. The boxes are opening soon. Would you like to join me? I wouldn't mind some company while I wait in line. The man looks up at you, lifting his hat to reveal a face made leathery by years in the sun, framed by a salt-and-pepper beard and punctuated with deep brown eyes. He's a tough-looking fellow, but his whisper of a grin is immediately disarming. Sure, why not? You approach and offer your hand. Pleased to make your acquaintance. The man shakes back. My name is Eduardo. You join Eduardo as you cross the square, heading towards the Palacio del Gobierno, in front of which several voting stations are being hastily set up by American soldiers and government officials. You watch as signs in English and Spanish go up atop each voting tent, reading Territorial Elections Commission. There's hardly a Mexican among those setting up, and this too draws jeering from the crowd.
So, what brings you to Monterrey?
Well, I've come to write about the election. Much of the world is watching and waiting to see what America is going to do with the Mexican territories. They've been here for 20 years now, but we can never get a straight answer about whether Mexico is merely occupied territory or an American state in its own right.
Is that what the world wonders about?
Eduardo takes a long drag on his pipe, letting whiskey plumes of smoke pour out from his nostrils.
America writes the laws. Americans tell us where we can and can't go. And the American takes a cut of everything I earn. I am sorry, but I am afraid your story is going to be a short one.
I don't know about that. I don't find the American character to be very indecisive. If they meant to conquer, they would have declared Mexico a state long ago. Personally, I think they mean to get out now that hostilities are at an end.
Válgame Dios. You haven't been here long, amigo. America rules Mexico. Except for Los Lobos in the south, but it is not safe to speak of such things. The question is whether they are going to give us a say or not.
You aren't voting for a free and sovereign Mexico, then?
Escúchame, pero. I don't care if the law comes from Mexico City or Washington. I just want my say. I'm sure if you asked my abuelo, he would have said that the Spaniards were bastards. But as long as his farm was his, the rest didn't matter.
You don't doubt the sincerity of Eduardo's position. Among all the shouting and ruckus still going on in the square, you have hardly heard the cry to liberate Mexico. Everyone hates the Americans, but nobody here has threatened to send them packing. You wonder if Eduardo is more or less pragmatic than the rest of Monterrey. It's doubtful that the Americans would tolerate cries for a free Mexico, but then, their number is not significant so far as you've seen in the city, and it's not as if the Mexicans lack the mettle to overthrow a world power. Certainly, the Mexicans could give it a go. For 20 years under American rule is but a fleeting moment compared to the centuries spent under the Spanish crown. Finally, the voting tents are all set up, and the commencement of the political ritual begins with a resounding booming of trumpets across the square. Government officials, all Americans at a glance, ascend the platforms and stand between the voting tents, and all urge the gathered masses to come closer as they begin instructing everyone on how voting will proceed. Eduardo, indifferent, gestures for you to follow, and then begins shoving his way through the crowd as he approaches the nearest voting tent. At first, people turn to scold him, but every time, you see a flash of recognition and immediate deference paid to this particular cowboy. Reaching the tent, a government official steps forward, waving his finger in Eduardo's face.
I'm sorry, senor, but we'd like everyone to form a line. And you were definitely not waiting here first.
Eduardo pays the official no mind,
walking right up to the table where an attendant sits with a box and a stack of blank ballots.
My name is Eduardo de Leon, aged 40 years. I would like to register to vote.
The attendant at the table looks flabbergasted, but his colleagues offer nothing but indifferent shrugs of the shoulder.
Do you have any identification?
Si.
Eduardo produces a pair of carefully folded sheets from inside of his jacket pocket and places them down on the table, unfolding them slowly, gently. He turns them over to the attendant.
These papers identify me as a captain in the army of Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna.
Do you have anything else?
No.
Well, this isn't enough. You certainly can't vote now with just this.
This was good enough for my president. Why isn't it good enough for yours?
There are procedures here. If you'd waited, someone would have explained to you that...
In a flash, Eduardo pulls a pistol from within his jacket and points it at the attendant. Equally as quickly, an array of rifles tipped with bayonets aim at Eduardo's head and back. The blades are so close that they could almost knock off his hat. The cry goes out for Eduardo to drop his weapon, but he holds steadfast, his pipe hanging out of his mouth, and his eyes focused on the attendant and the ballots on the table.
My ballot, please.
The attendant doesn't know what to do. American soldiers inch closer, pressing the tips of their bayonets into Eduardo's back. Glancing around, you can also see officers aiming pistols at Eduardo from on horseback. Further commands to lower his weapon go unheeded. And from the looks of the officers, any moment now, one of them will give the order to shoot.
You diablos can take my country, but you won't take our voice. Give me, and every man here, their ballot.
The attendant sweats like a pig, and even some of the American soldiers lose their focus for a moment, needing to wipe the sweat from their brows as this midday standoff leaves everyone at the edge of action. And then, a murmur goes up from among the crowd. The gathered citizens of Monterrey begin to complain, growing more irate with every passing moment, demanding that they be given their ballots. The grumbling turns into shouting, and soon, people are screaming, crying out for their ballots. Half of the soldiers with their weapons trained on Eduardo turn to face the crowd and are joined by more of their comrades from the garrison. But still, they are fiercely outnumbered. And with the citizens surrounding the mounted officers, shaking their fists at them, the situation is quickly growing untenable. Eduardo, throughout all of this, remains focused on the man obstructing him and the pile of ballots in front of him. Frightened for his life, the attendant finally gives way. Picking up his pen and carefully lifting Eduardo's paper up for a better look, as he scrawls Eduardo's name in a register and then hands him back his papers with a ballot. Eduardo receives his papers and lowers his gun, sliding it back into its holster. He coolly walks into the tent where a screen is set up behind which he can vote. He never turns once to look at the soldiers who are still aiming their weapons at him. After a long beat, Eduardo returns and hands a folded ballot to the attendant, watching to ensure that it does in fact go into the box. And that business finally done, Eduardo walks past the soldiers, still threatening him with their guns, pausing only a moment to shake your hand and dump out the contents of his pipe.
I hope your story won't be so short after all. If you are in town for a little longer, I have a ranch just west of the mountain, the Cerro de la Silla. You are welcome to visit any time.
And with that, Eduardo removes his hat and then walks off, melting into the crowd who seemed to fold in around him, obscuring him from your view and from that of the bewildered soldiers. As the officers try to bark orders to pursue the man, the crowd becomes louder still, drowning out every other voice. Turning back to the polling stations, you find them mobbed by people, all holding up their papers, demanding to be registered to vote. It took one man, but now the people of Monterrey will have their say.
was A Man from Monterey by Kevin Valbenesi. In the next Weird Tale of America, Tristan Verboven will take you on a journey into the early days after the Revolution. The Barbary pirates were always a thorn in the side of the fledgling state, but the problem is about to get worse. Much worse. Before we launch into this story, I'd like to recommend a podcast to you. History of the United States is a show by one of my oldest podcasting friends, Jamie Redfern. He's done incredible work over the years, covering entire histories of the Punic Wars, the Arab Spring, and Alexander the Great. His monumental show, The History of the United States, is a marquee podcast. If you're enjoying these weird tales of America and you want to gain more context, I would highly recommend you check it out. Listen to this short trailer.
Who doesn't like a good story? If you're listening to Twilight Histories, I know you love one. How about a story that's got everything? Global conflicts, revolution, theological awakenings, political intrigue, betrayal, and characters trying and failing to match their ideals with their reality. What I'm describing is, of course, a history of the United States. I'm Jamie Redfern, and I've been telling this story for the past 6 years on the A History of the United States podcast. If you'd like to join in, you can find it on your favourite podcasting platforms. Now, without further ado, on with the show.
It is the summer of 1794, and Joel Barlow is trying his best to read the latest print of Lloyd's Shipping List as his carriage bumps and sways. You wouldn't know it by the quaint French countryside as it passes, but France is in the grips of a bloody revolution. The people have risen from all segments of society to rid themselves of an aging, obsolete monarchy, and are forming what they hope is a fair and well-thought-out republic. Both the new Republican army and the Loyalist Guard have had to resort to violence and depravity to get where they are right now. To Joel Barlow, an American in France, business is booming. There is a kind of assumed kinship between the two nations. Despite any differences that they may have, they are both revolutionary brothers in arms. And shipping supplies to moving armies on both sides has become Monsieur Barlow's prime focus. So when he receives a sealed letter from a general of the Republican Army of the West, he makes his way to meet him at once. An eyeglass scans slowly across the clustered farmhouses and hayfields. Over the gentle rolling hills of the Loire Valley, until it finds the dusty train of a carriage bobbing up the tree-lined avenue leading to the courtyard. The device is snapped shut to reveal a strikingly handsome young man with dark skin and tight black curls continuing down his cheek into sideburns elegantly brushing up against the stiff, gold-trimmed collar of his uniform. He turns to his attendant. "Pas de protocole," he says sternly. "Passez-le tout de suite." With a click step, the attendant backs out of the room, closing the large doors behind him, leaving the room silent. But he is not alone. A man with rough, dark features sits awkwardly in a sumptuous chair, running his tri-point hat between his fingers, And behind him, lurking sloppily about the room, are two swarthy types, dressed in an Eastern style, one of them grinning his rotten gold teeth, the other giving nothing but a blank, boorish frown. Placing the spyglass carefully in the drawer by the window, the uniformed man exits the room and descends the long hallway, his boots creaking the floor noisily. At the bottom of the broad stairway, he greets his visitor as he arrives, in French. And then he nods for his Batman to leave. "Welcome to La Grande Janier, Monsieur Barlow. Thank you for coming on such short notice. Monsieur David de la Pailleterie, it is an honor to see you again. Never mind these pleasantries, Monsieur Barlow. I am now General Dumas of the Army of the West. But for our purposes, you may call me Alex Dumas." Barlow has the dashing stride of an American, chiseled features and steely eyes, and his kerchief cravat is tied smart and tight. He takes his host's hand firmly. "General, well, well. If I recall, on our first meeting, Monsieur Dumas, you were a lieutenant colonel in the Black Legion. That was scarcely 2 years ago. This revolution is bringing out quite a few battlefield promotions. You will find that I merit them, monsieur." Dumas gracefully motions him to follow as they mount the steps of the opulent chateau. "We had plenty of those in our revolution, too," continues Barlow. "You are too young to recall, of course. If I'm not mistaken, I was being enslaved on the plantation in Saint-Dominique at the time," chuckles the general grimly. "Yes, of course," replies Barlow. "It was such an extraordinary rise, this new revolutionary fervor." Atop the stairs, the men stand face to face. "Any person who puts his foot in France is no longer a slave, no matter his race. This has been so long before the revolution." Both men push out their chests, gnashing their jaws. Dumas leads him towards the room and stops in front of the door. "I did not call you here to discuss my career, Monsieur Barlow. La politique non plus." He pauses before reaching for the doorknob. "Upon our first meeting, you presented me with a letter of introduction by the former consul in Paris, Monsieur Jefferson. Vous rappelez bien? In it, he described you as a capable man of extraordinary abilities and connections, and an intimate of Monsieur Jefferson himself. You will find, Monsieur Dumas, that I am worthy of all those things. Then I shall now introduce you to a man whose presence here at Chateau Jaunier is known to no one but you and me. He has a message of terrible gravity for you." He opens the door and leads him in. As they enter the Grand Salle, the man stands up hastily, only to be stopped by the hand of one of the two brutes. "Voilà Monsieur Joël Barlow," says Dumas to the man. "He is an American and can bring your message to Washington." Barlow looks around the room inquisitively. "Somebody please tell me what this is about." "Monsieur Barlow, this is Luigi Giuseppe, first mate of the frigate Minerve." He looks at him gravely. "This ship sailed from Boston transporting an American by the name of James Monroe." "Ah! The new consul, appointed by Mr. Jefferson himself. He's expected to arrive any day." Barlow looks at the man. "What news of his passage?" The man stands up again, and this time the brutes allow him. Looking over his shoulder nervously, he hands Barlow a silk pocket kerchief monogrammed with J.M. "The news I have of Monsieur Monroe is a matter of national attention, sir." Barlow puts up his hand to stop him and stares down the brutes. "Who are these men?" he demands. Dumas steps in. "These men are inseparable to Monsieur Giuseppe for his duration in France. They arrived with him in La Rochelle on a vessel from Tunis. They are here to see that the terms are properly communicated. The smaller of the two brutes comes to life, revealing at once a ghastly smirk. Barlow pauses for a moment in horror, looking into the desperate eyes of the first mate. A vessel from Tunis? He turns to the general. Why, Monsieur Dumas, these men are Barbary pirates.
Pirates, laughs the corsair through a bog of gold teeth. Yes, monsieur, pirates, pirates, yes.
In the dark hull of a ship, after days of swaying and buckling, too many days to count, for some days have had no light at all, and others have lasted an eternity. And James Monroe has found a way to prop his head to rest in the foul recess of a damp wooden box. Closes his sore, shallow eyes in search of sleep. And in that tranquil place, memories come to his mind. He is at the home of his friend, Thomas Jefferson, having breakfast à la française to celebrate his appointment as consul in Paris.
What kind of revolution may be having?
Think of all those before you have come and had this honor. Best send for your family once you're there.
Who knows what kind of revolution may be having?
His mind drifts into another memory. An older one. They are in Richmond at the market, holding the hand of his father, a family of slaves huddled on a platform. His father calling out bids. A man with a stick beating the poor woman as her child is pried from her clutches. He can hear the whizzing of shots overhead, artillery fire in the distance. Monroe rushes below deck to destroy his documents until the corsairs burst into the room, climbing the rigging, daggers in their mouths. His eyes are thrust open to another horrible spectacle. This one is real. Body is being hoisted by the leg, raised to a winch in the opening above. And besides the holes drilled into the hull, it is the sole source of light, air, and sometimes food. Not enough to lessen the squalor, and the air is unbreathable. It is unclear how many souls are down here with him. His ghastly leg irons allow him to see no more than the first three layers of bodies across. Shoulder to shoulder with other men, all confined to their filth in darkness. The ship sways, and the briny swamp on the floor occasionally splashes up into their faces. Nobody speaks. Nobody has spoken for days. Just moans and shrieks of madness that permeate the stench of death. Now the seas have calmed. The heat has done nothing to improve the air. The sea is still. Still enough to hear the splash of the body, the ghoulish snarl of the sharks devouring it. Sometime later, the sound of small boats rub up against the port side, and voices call out in Arabic. With scarves covering their faces, some corsairs descend into the filth. With whips and devices built for this sole purpose, they unshackle the bodies and gather them a dozen at a time into a cargo net, where they are hoisted into the light. When it is Monroe's turn, he stumbles with a groan, not having used his legs in weeks, and then recoils into the blinding sun. Crammed like livestock into the net, he can barely open his eyes in the blazing light. Just enough to make out the port of a vast city. All around are stone fortifications and trading ships and a curious crowd gathering below. They are lowered to a trough in the middle of a bustling harbor, and to the delight of onlookers are told to undress and wash. Still scowling from the sun, Monroe is happy to relieve himself of the now tattered, wretched rags and fills his lungs with air, drinking to his thirst. They are surrounded by spearmen in black faces, turban and cloak, with thick belts around their waists filled with daggers and ornate pistols. As his vision returns, he observes his surroundings. They are in the Arabian world, presumably Africa. People are dressed in long flowing robes, their hair covered in cotton headdress. The buildings are flat-roofed mud dwellings, and in every direction there's a skyline of onion-shaped buildings. Each prisoner is tossed some rags to wear and a blanket. As Monroe puts them on, he's interrupted by a large, reddish-brown-skinned man with leathery complexion and dark, piercing eyes set narrowly on his face. His head is wrapped in a magnificent blue shroud. His hand darts out, clutching him firmly by the chin. It smells like jasmine, and is adorned by a splendid ring. He holds Monroe steady as his companions chain his ankles to the man next to him. Then another man approaches. He's one of the corsairs who took their ship. He points out to the Minerve out in the harbor, and then points to some of the other members of the crew. With his other hand, the man in blue forces his mouth open to check his teeth. He then examines his arms and legs, pinching his flesh. Then, pulling back Monroe's ragged tunic, he inspects the bullet wound in his shoulder, poking it to see if he will flinch. Satisfied with his examination, he moves on to the next set of shackles. Monroe looks at the procession that has been unloaded from the ship. In addition to the ones he recognizes from his crew, there are several men, women, and children, some of them Africans, some of them Europeans, all of them now slaves. At the crack of a whip, they are marched two by two through the narrow streets of the city, following a train of camels and pack animals. They pass marketplaces, mosques, shops, gawking onlookers, and a group of boys who throw rocks at them as they pass. The moment the whip man is out of earshot, the African man that Monroe is chained to speaks in a low voice.
"You're an Englishman."
"American," mutters Monroe, surprised by the sound of his own voice.
"Me too," replies the man. "Born in Virginia."
Monroe is taken aback, but silenced again by the crack of a whip. They turn a corner to the main road, and to the jarring sight of a long line of wretched slaves, waddling in the other direction with heavy baskets of stone on their backs. Their faces are lifeless and white with dust, and their bodies broken under the weight. Men, women, young and old, and from every faith and nationality, their hair in dark matted clumps and stiffened locks of tarnished straw. And one by one, James Monroe looks into their sullen resign for a sign of life, seeing nothing but the ghostly visages of broken souls. Monroe speaks again.
"It seems soon we'll be joining them." "You are already one of them," he replies grimly. "The sailors will probably die in the oars of ships, and then women will do domestic work. The pretty ones, at least."
"And those awaiting ransom?"
"These Berbers are all business," he grunts. "They like to keep their reputation."
Soon they reach the city gates. The line leads out towards a limestone quarry, dotted with countless hands tapping at the stone face. And when the opportunity arises again, Monroe speaks.
"I'm James," he says to his companion.
"Cato,"
replies the man.
"Tell me, Cato, how does a Negro man from Virginia come to be on an African slave ship?"
"Same way as you, I suppose."
He pauses for a moment.
"I was born a slave, but I've been a free man for years. I earned my freedom fighting for the British.
I dare say we have likely faced in battle," replies Monroe.
"After independence, I joined the Loyalists and settled in Nova Scotia. Later, with the help of abolitionists, we moved to Sierra Leone, where I was captured again."
The whip cracks again, and Monroe and his companion continue on their slow, sad march.
"How different our lives have been," sighs Monroe. "And yet our fate is the same."
They now enter the quarry where scores of slaves are packing stones into baskets and loading them onto their backs. And they are corralled towards a dark mine opening in the hillside. And before entering, Cato speaks.
"I know nothing of fate," he says sternly. "You may think that you have once fought for your freedom, James, though it didn't include mine. You may feel more kin to the men with the whips than the ones in chains. But we are now bound by more than just chains. Once a man has gained his freedom, he can never again be enslaved. And I intend to fight for mine again."
James Monroe, taking in the horrors around him, can scarcely imagine what awaits him in the darkness of the cavern. All he knows is that all those who leave it do so with sunken eyes broken souls, crushed under rocks, thrashed by whips, and starved to despair. And in the last bit of African sun, before they crouch down into the foul darkness, Cato turns and looks him in the eyes, the way that no black man had ever done before that day, and says to him these words that give him the hope and the will to survive. "We are all brothers," says Cato. "We are all brothers now." And so he went, dear listener, into the darkness of the mine. No more or less willing than any other before him. And for how long? An eternity, perhaps. James Monroe, a learned man of good Virginian stock, a hero of the Revolution, founding father to a nation, and future president of the United States, reduced to a wretched slave at the hands of pirates, vestiges of an ancient civilization. But there is hope for his soul. His fate is in the hands of capable men, each with his own score to settle. A cunning entrepreneur, a powerful French general, the President of the United States, and a shacklemate with an eye on his freedom. What happens next is left to the imagination.
That was James Monroe and the Barbary Pirates by Tristan Verboven. In our first tale, you are down in the scorching hot lands of the Mexican territories. In the second story, you are in the high seas. In this next weird tale, you will travel far up to the ice-capped mountains of Alaska. Before we begin, a quick word about this podcast. We are listener-supported. All our podcasters are passionate storytellers, but passion alone can't put food on the table. Our Patreon community provides the funds we need to pay our podcasters a good, fair wage for their work. And of course, the more patrons we have, the more great stories we can ask our team to produce. When you join us on Patreon, we give you a lot. You get to hear all the stories before they go up live. And many of them, like the ones you're hearing today, were listener-generated ideas. You get access to bonus tracks, an entire podcast I never launched called The Dark Histories that takes first-hand accounts and dramatizes them, and you get a ton of early Twilight History shows you won't hear on the public podcast. If that's not all, you also get Twilight History's merchandise for signing up. Depending on your tier, you will either get stickers, a mug, a t-shirt, or a Twilight Histories hoodie. Most importantly, as a patron, you're my people, my tribe. I've gotten to know some of our group really well, and I want to know you, too. So head on over to our website at twilighthistories.com and click through to our Patreon page. It's going to be fun. And now, on to our next story. This is Russian Alaska by Devin Field.
The theater outside provides one northern sun-struck scene after another. The window lighting up with imagery cast in the crisp, cold air. It's been like this ever since you crossed the border, since you left the state of Washington behind, and then the westernmost reaches of Canada, heading north. You had boarded this train in Seattle, found the carriage still gleaming and new. The coastal mountains flowing past, spectacular. The ocean cutting into the wooded land on your left in coves and inlets. Little secrets of this coast that are revealed to you only fleetingly before dropping away. Your destination is just ahead. The train station you're now approaching is a magnificent work of Neo-Byzantine design. That of Constantine Ton himself, architect of so much that catches your eye in this city rolling past. Novo Arkhangelsk, new archangel. Novo Novo Arkhangelsk, you chuckle inwardly to yourself. When the influx had come, a mainland location had been felt to be more appropriate than that of the community which originally bore the name. The train slows, and as it enters the station, you gasp. What you're seeing is the face with which the city turns to welcome its newer arrivals. And it is, undeniably, an impressive one. The space is cavernous, but scarcely any of its walls go unadorned by rich mosaics. Scarcely any untouched by the Tsar's wealth. You step down onto the platform and stand transfixed. Some of the images are unfamiliar to you. Rulers, heroes, and scenes from Russian history. Saints from the Orthodox Church. Others you do recognize. Just ahead is a city being sacked. Perhaps Constantinople. Next to it is what you are fairly sure is a towering Patriarch Innocent. And nearby, an even more towering Nicholas II. A youngish-looking man, hair neatly parted on the left, a thin mustache and hint of beard. His clothing, martial and grand. Expression, oddly pensive. Between the bustle of the station and your preoccupation with its decor, you are in a state of deep distraction, not at all conscious of the man hovering next to you. Not until he coughs and speaks your name. Mr. Davis? Ambassador Richard Davis? You blink. Yes? You turn away from your contemplation of the mosaics. Yes, that's me. You turn towards him. Him being the neatly dressed little man who now stands next to you, his hand extended. You take it. And you must be Farnum, yes? My office told me you would be here, but I was just... You trail off a moment, gesturing behind you at the walls. I was just surprised. He nods. New Archangel is not the sleepy town we once talked of buying. All these people, all this money, it is the jewel of the continent. Or if not now, then soon. You give him a somewhat skeptical smile, one he meets with a knowing look. You'll see. You can hardly believe what you see as the carriage rolls through the city. You'd been informed of the situation before you left. You had, of course, followed events in the newspapers these past years and studied the history behind them. You'd followed the threads. You knew that the Russian Tsar had squeezed out every bit of financial advantage that he could. After his defensive military successes on the Crimean Peninsula had led to further, more offensive ones against the Ottomans and others. Then Nicholas I had gleefully devoured what the beleaguered French and British sides had left on the table. And that his empire, previously thought to be going into decline, had flowered anew. But not for everyone. No. Not for everyone at all. You stare out at row after row of grand, imperious buildings, each one more conspicuous in its expression of affluence than the last. You had done the reading, but it had not prepared you for this. Farnham allows you to absorb it all, just pointing out the occasional landmark as you pass. There is the Novo Arkhangelsk Theater, the exquisite home of what you understand to be a quite remarkable orchestra. And there is the Bridge of St. Sergius. There is the Epiphany Cathedral, perhaps the largest Orthodox cathedral in the world, you have been told. And there is the palace. You are not going there now. Farnham clears his throat. He tips his chin towards the window and begins to speak. It isn't easy to take in, is it? You nod in assent, your eyes following what you take to be another palace, the approach flanked by Egyptian statuary. He continues. They know that here, and they revel in it. They wield their flourishing like a blunt object. You should know that. As he speaks, the carriage turns to follow the edges of a vast square. A perfect space for political rallies. Perfect, you think, for a military march. Please understand that this is not the end, Farnham says. New Russia has not yet flowered. What I need you to realize is that it is yet to fully bloom. They're serious, then, you ask him. They're serious about their offer. Oh, yes, he answers. They are quite serious. A similar offer has been made to the British. In fact, it has already been accepted. Then you mean? He nods grimly. Yes. The final arrangements have been made in Ottawa. All previously British lands west of the Rocky Mountains are to be Russian. The two of you settle into silence for a bit as the carriage rolls on. At the hotel, you pause to refresh yourself and to think over what you've seen and heard. Back in Washington, D.C., your briefing had left you feeling fully confident in yourself and your mission. Now that you're here, though, some of that certainty has ebbed away. You recall your meeting with the Secretary of State, how he told you about the Russian offer to purchase Washington and Oregon, how he'd said that he and President McKinley had laughed about it. The Tsar's thirst for otters must be absolutely unquenchable, they joked. But here, among all this newly constructed splendor, and in light of the news that the British had already sold land, the idea seemed distinctly less absurd. Not that you were here to pursue it. You doubt that McKinley would think much of that. You're here to shake hands. You're here to prop open every door with a smile and the amiable assurance that yes, of course, all things were possible, even if they weren't. Especially if they weren't. You give yourself one last look in the mirror. You are ready for the palace. The carriage is waiting for you downstairs, but no sign of Farnham. Some business must have pulled him away, but surely he'll meet you there. Your hands flutter nervously about your tie and collar, and then rest on your lap as New Archangel parades past. It's a short ride, and before you can force yourself to fully relax, it's over. Hands are pulling open the door on your side. Faces speak greetings you scarcely register. You're bustled through the ornate exterior doors and up the stairs within. Masterpieces in marble keeping step with you on either side. A series of well-dressed waitstaff juggling your way along one corridor after another. It's all just this way, sir. And just over here, please. and you have very little idea of where you are or what direction you're heading. But then a last set of doors gives way before you, and you're announced to the high-ceilinged space on the other side. Its walls as bedecked with wealth as the people who swirl within them. You've honestly never seen anything like it. You receive a glass of wine, then a barrage of cheerful greetings, a second glass, and you're being toured about the room with a Russian prince at your side. Or at least, you think that's who he is. You manage to break away at some point another half glass in and swim towards the balcony. It is all so hard to take in. You feel exhausted by the train ride and badly disoriented by this place. You knew of it before you came, of how unrest in Russia had caused the imperial elite to flee their homes and flood this distant outpost. How they'd brought along as much of their treasure and comforts as they could manage. Clearly, as much as they could manage was a great deal. Enough to outshine anything you have ever seen before. You need a moment, but you're not going to get it. Another introduction. It's the Emperor himself. The Tsar. He's gripping your hand tightly before you've even managed to fully extend it, with his other hand patting you on the side in an affectionate way. You can see Farnum over his shoulder, his face a little concerned. You miss what the Tsar is saying. Your Majesty, you manage. It's an honor, but he waves away your further politeness, cutting across it with a jovial stream of words. As he spins you toward the view outside and gestures expansively, his hand taking in the city and waters before you, and then running off along the ocean's edge until it disappears. A Russian coast, he booms, from north to south. Can you picture it? You need only nod. You can. You certainly can.
That was Russian Alaska by Devin Field. And that's the end of your adventure for today. If you enjoyed these stories, let me know how we did in a review. I always appreciate a good review, and I give your feedback a lot of thought. In fact, when you join our Patreon community, you'll see we just had a giant conversation about the last review someone left for us on Apple Podcasts. It really got us all thinking. It sparked a very constructive conversation. Whoever you were that left that review, and I see your alias is Vonderon, thank you. And also thank you to Wootsie1 for a really nice review as well. I love your kind words. They're story-making fuel. Please come and join us on Patreon if you haven't done so already. Tons of extra shows to unlock, early access to new shows, great conversations, merch, and so much more. Visit twilighthistories.com and click through to our Patreon page. That's twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to The Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.
California has the largest population in the United States and the site of some of the most famous true crime cases in history. But there's more than meets the eye to the crime in California. Join Sean, Jessica, and Charles on the California True Crime Podcast as they cover crime both infamous and overlooked from around our state while looking at the deeper history that goes beyond beaches and movie stars.